This hypersonic episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the glorious web wizards and their crystal palaces over at squarespace.com. No longer does humanity have to worry about the satanic, quivering proboscis of some pseudo-web designer injecting itself into our bank accounts. Go to squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan and you will get 10% off your first order. If you sign up for a year, you will get a free domain name. Squarespace.com. Build it beautiful. Hello, friends. It's me, Duncan, and I'm reporting in from Pittsburgh, somewhere in the midst of the Squarespace Presents You Are God comedy tour. And I'm having one of the greatest Aprils of my life. Not only have I been given the opportunity to travel around on a bus doing stand-up every single night, which is already one of the greatest things ever, but to add to that insanely beautiful yet unfortunately temporary existence, I have also gotten to do podcasts with three of the top psychedelic luminaries living today: Alex Gray, Allison Gray, and Rick Doblin. And all of these podcasts are coinciding with what may be one of the most psychedelic months in human history, outside of the month that LSD was synthesized and outside of the month that the first proto-hominid stumbled upon a mushroom-covered bit of bovine dung growing on the primordial grasslands and shoved those mushrooms into its cracked, jagged, slavering proto-hominid mouth hole, thus experiencing the very first psychedelic trip, which according to many people led to the expansion of the neocortex, the evolution of language, the beginnings of religion, and ultimately led to this incredible time in human history where we are about to bring artificial intelligence to life. It's pretty cool, and this month is particularly psychedelic for three different reasons that I can think of. The first being that for the first time, they have done brain imaging of a human brain on LSD. And this is an incredible thing. It's always been a mystery what happens to us when that magical substance makes its way into our memory jam. But now we can see that when you take LSD, it creates all kinds of brand new connections in the human brain that, according to the sound bites I've found on the articles I've skimmed, is very similar to the way that an infant's brain works. So when you're on LSD, it's as though you are transforming into a kind of enlightened baby. And it's incredible to think, and this is something that anyone has thought, if you've been around a baby, if you spend any time at all with an infant, one of the first things you think is, my God, this guy seems like he's on a lot of acid. They are tripping, right? They seem like they're tripping. No, they're not tripping. They're just existing in a pure primordial state of connectivity and innocence. And that is the exact same state that if you've had a great trip, you've experienced. And what an incredible relief to slip back into that Garden of Eden style state of consciousness when for the majority of your life you've been encased in the terrible neurological thought prison that you call your identity, that awful series of habituations and concepts of what's right and what's wrong that just surround you like barbed wire around an angel. LSD has freed so many of us from that prison. And it's incredible to see that that state of consciousness is not some kind of abnormal state of schizophrenia or some kind of state of lunacy or some kind of state of going insane, but is actually a return to the primary consciousness that we all get to experience for a few years in the beginning of our lives. And that's a really beautiful thing. It's an incredible thing, but it also shows us that one thing that we may need to implement in all the hospitals of the United States of America is a kind of vaginal prison that we can put on the vaginas of women who are giving birth. I picture it as a sort of like a solitary confinement cage for babies so that the moment those little darlings get shot out of the vagina, they're immediately locked in one of these cages and shipped to penal colonies for infants, because every single baby that you are seeing when you're out there at a Starbucks or maybe your own baby or whoever it may be are experiencing an illegal state of consciousness that the federal government has for many years deemed so dangerous that they have mandated a 5-year mandatory minimum for people who dare to allow their minds to slip back into the state of infantile consciousness that, according to the federal government, is just as dangerous as this experience of injecting the poison of heroin into your veins or snorting crystal meth. So let's lock up the babies. That's one thing that I've learned from this new study on LSD, is that every single baby walking on the earth today is a drug offender who should be at least handcuffed. So maybe somebody out there who has an entrepreneurial spirit could invent baby handcuffs or vaginal prisons so we can solve this awful problem. It kind of explains what's wrong with society, right? We're all born criminals. That's what happens. We're born criminals, and thanks to the state, we are re-educated and transformed into highly functioning adults who know right from wrong. This is one reason that it's one of the most psychedelic months in human history. And obviously, I'm joking about the baby prisons. I don't think babies should be locked up in prisons. I think babies should be immediately launched into outer space to some other planet. Let's get rid of the babies altogether. I don't think we should allow them to contaminate our planet with their awful innocence and complete disregard for all human laws. The other reason it's an incredibly psychedelic month is because at this very moment, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which is the organization that Rick Doblin founded, is raising money to create, to synthesize a kilogram of MDMA, because they are doing FDA-approved studies which are having great results and which are probably going to lead to MDMA being a prescribable medicine. So there are ways that you can now chip in this historic moment in human history. All you have to do is go to the MAPS website. Links will be in the comments section of this episode, and donate a little money or chip in some way right now at this crucial time so that we can get this MDMA legally synthesized and continue these very important tests that Rick Doblin has gotten, has made legal. It's incredible. This guy is a real saint. He's awesome. Now, that's the second reason that it's a psychedelic month. The third reason it's a psychedelic month, and you'll find more about this on next week's podcast, which gets released April 19th, is because Alex and Allison Gray are in, I suppose what you could say, the final phase or the next phase of building their beautiful temple, Entheon, in upstate New York, which is a kind of nexus point for the incredible art church that they have created and for the awesome community of people who have gathered around them and who have, in varying ways, been using art as a means to connect to the universe. And it's a beautiful, it's a beautiful religion, and I know religion has a lot of negative connotations, but it's a beautiful philosophy that is being propagated by Alex and Allison Gray over at COSM. And so I got to visit with them. I got to see Entheon. I got to witness this embryonic temple, and I had my mind blown, as I always do, by hanging out with those two, and especially by being on their beautiful property, which I think anyone can visit. They have a bed and breakfast over there with some of their art is on all the walls, and they're just a variety of super cool people who are always hanging out there, including Alex and Allison Gray. So that podcast comes out next week. Regardless, this has been one of the most mind-melting months of my life, and I'm really grateful that I get a chance to experience it all. And that's all because of you guys for listening to this podcast. So much thanks to you. We're going to dive right into this episode, but first, some quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Glory Angels over at Squarespace.com. I was just watching one of these weird shows that is on TV, and somehow there's like a whole genre of these shows now, like Shark Tank, where essentially these billionaire entrepreneurs go around finding folks who make special napkin covers and jams and weird products and buy millions of dollars worth of these products for their businesses. So if you've got a nice If you're a glass blower and you want to get your glass blown vases in a billion Bubba Gump shrimp companies, then if you're lucky, this amazing godlike billionaire who runs the Golden Saddle or whatever that hotel is in Vegas will come to your glass blowing place, chastise you for how slow you are when you create your art, and if you're lucky, he'll get you to water down your art to the point where you can sell it to him wholesale, and obese drunks shoving shrimp into their face at Bubba Gump's can completely ignore your flower holder on their table. It's a weird, I don't know what to think of it, but anyway, the whole point is, last night as I was watching one of these things, falling asleep, and I had nightmares for the entire night, I woke up my beautiful, beloved Cora screaming in the middle of the night, and I think it was because of watching these shows. It also may have been because I ate a bunch of chocolate right before I fell asleep, but anyway, one of these shows, this leather worker was taken to some Manhattan web design building where these charlatan sons of guns told this guy that for a 7-page website, they normally charge $100,000. Think about that, $100,000 for a 7-page website. If you make me pay $100,000 for a 7-page website, there better be a page on there where I can press a button and it brings my mom and my grandmother back to life. Because otherwise, it's a ripoff. Don't get hoodwinked by these charlatan bastards who will drag you like a cowboy whose boot is stuck in a stirrup through a cactus garden. And at the end of this awful dragging, you'll be dead broke and you'll have a website that is a little worse than a website you could easily have made by going to squarespace.com. Squarespace.com. Go there, use offer code Duncan, you'll get 10% off a brand new beautiful website. All of the websites come with shopping carts, which mean you can immediately start selling whatever the thing is you want to sell. If you're a glass blower, you don't have to wait for some billionaire reptilian to come farting into your workshop and tell you that you're too slow. You can immediately build a website and start selling your beautiful glass-blown trinkets right now. You don't need a brick-and-mortar website. You don't a brick-and-mortar store. You don't have to build a store on some dangerous corner where somebody high on bath salts is going to come and chew your face off. You don't have to die that horrible death laying in a pool of your own blood, staring at one of your eyeballs that is being sucked back into the cracked lips of some bath salt maniac who's eating it like a little bit of pasta at a Bubba Gump shrimp company. No, you don't have to risk your life. You can just go to squarespace.com, use offer code Duncan, and you'll get 10% off a brand new website. And if you sign up for a year, you will get a free domain name. What could be better than that? Squarespace, I owe you my life. Thank you, my sweet, darling patrons. I've already been shipping babies to you. Every time I have a baby, and I've been having a lot of babies over the last few months, I ship them to the offices over at Squarespace. So if you guys have been getting a lot of babies, they've all been coming from me. We've got a little bit more advertising to do, and then we're going to jump right into this podcast. And I apologize that every single time I do an episode over this month, I will be listing the upcoming shows. So here's what's going on. We have got, right now I'm at Pittsburgh, and if you listen to this episode right now and happen to be in Pittsburgh, then please come see me. I'm going to be at the Rex Theater. Then I'm going to be in Columbus on the 13th, that's tomorrow, Cleveland on the 14th, Ferndale on the 15th, Toronto on the 16th, two shows in Toronto. Both of these shows have almost sold out. Go check on the website. There may be some tickets left. I'm not sure, but I think they're both sold out, but it's worth checking. Chicago on the 17th, Madison on the 19th. I believe that we are sold out in Madison too. I think there's a few tickets left for that. You can go to all these, by the way, all these ticket links are at DuncanTrussell.com. We're in Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Nashville, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and then I'm going to be in Maui at the Ram Dass Spring Retreat. So I hope you guys will come to one of these shows. As I mentioned before, I'm having an incredibly amazing time meeting all of you, and I hope to see some of you at these upcoming shows. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. If you go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com, the next time you're going to buy something on Amazon, for example, a brand new Oculus Rift, then they will give us a very small percentage of anything that you buy. And it's a great way to support this podcast, and it costs you nothing. We also have t-shirts, posters, and stickers located at DuncanTrussell.com. For those of you asking who are at the first few shows of the tour who weren't able to get a t-shirt, those will be on sale at the end of the tour. A limited number of the You Are God t-shirts will be on sale, so keep your eye out for that. Okay, everybody, thanks for hanging in there. Now, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, a pioneer in the world of psychedelics, somebody who, while I was when I was young and having mind-opening experiences on LSD and thinking how absolutely insane it was that these blissful states had somehow been criminalized by the state, when I was impotently bitching about this to my friends, Rick Doblin was actively doing everything in his power to transform the draconian drug laws that have scheduled some of these life-improving psychedelics in the same category as they schedule heroin and meth to a place where they could be prescribed by doctors. So this is a hard-working, as far as I'm concerned, this is a saint. And already his hard work is paying off, and we're finding out that MDMA is a treatment for PTSD, which is a disorder that has really destroyed zillions of lives all over the planet. And he's just getting started. So as I mentioned before, if you want to find out more about Rick, go to his website, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. Links will be at DuncanTrussell.com. If you want to hear more of a conversation with Rick, he just did a podcast with the great Joe Rogan on the Joe Rogan Experience that you can download. So, okay, enough of that. Now, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, the amazing Rick Doblin. Rick Doblin.
Duncan.
This is such a surreal moment for me. Suddenly, I'm on a bus in Boston, and I'm sitting across from one of the pioneers of psychedelics, who is doing so. You're doing so much work for us right now, and it's just a real
honor for me
to have
too.
Me.
Yeah.
I want to start off by asking if you could just update me on where MAPS currently is right now when it comes to getting MDMA prescribable. I know you guys have been raising money to manufacture a batch of MDMA, but what's going on?
Well, things have dramatically changed for the better because of a meeting this afternoon that took place. And what we're doing is summarizing 15 years of research with MDMA in PTSD patients that we've done at a cost of somewhere near $7 million with support and other aspects of it. And we're gathering it for presentation to the FDA for phase 3 studies. And this transition, what it means is phase 2 is pilot studies where you're trying to just explore and understand who do you want to treat, how does your method work, what doses do you want to use, what patients does it really work in, who doesn't it work in, how do you understand the risks and benefits of these drugs, and then also how strong is the effect and how variable it is. And all of that gives you the idea of how to design these big studies that are going to be used to approve the drug, proving safety and efficacy. So it moves into a whole different realm. And all of academic research, there's all sorts of scientific research, that's non-drug development. So this is a certain kind of science.
Right.
That it's not just trying to figure out, how, it's about alleviating suffering. It's not about knowledge. And that's something really important for people to understand the difference. That, and there's an aspect of commercial marketing, of approval, of legal approval for a medicine. So it's about getting MDMA approved by the FDA.
Right.
So what we're doing is summarizing all of our data from the last 15 years about safety and efficacy, and reaching out to the other researchers all over the world who've treated about another 1,000 people. So there's been 1,100 people have been MDMA, not patients, but in scientific studies.
Okay.
So we're trying to gather up all of that data, and then
how
gather
much data how much data is there per person? Like, what's the volume of data per person that you have?
Well, everybody is treated with this course of psychotherapy that is about 3.5 months, and it's all videotaped. So, and we have weekly non-drug psychotherapy sessions, and then three different times we'll have eight-hour MDMA sessions that start at 10 in the morning, go till 6 at night.
What's the dosage? How many milligrams?
Well, we're doing all different. So these, what I mean, this is these exploratory studies.
Right.
So we've done some where it's an inactive placebo. We've done some with 25 milligrams, 30 milligrams, 40 milligrams. And those doses we're trying to figure out double blind. Can we, can we confuse people as to whether they actually got that, or they got 75 milligrams, which we also use, 100 and 125. And even in one study we did 150. So we're doing all these different. And then we also have this very smart idea, I think, of administering supplemental doses of half the initial dose after between 1.5 and 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
As a decision between the therapist and the patient. So we're trying to give a certain fixed range, but variability and
right.
fine-tuning, not just according to the psychological or physiological different ways. So then there's this eight-hour session. They spend the night in the treatment center. Then the next day they come back, and there's 2 or 3 hours sometimes of integrative psychotherapy about what happened before. Somebody else comes, picks them up. They can't drive home. Then we call them every day on the phone for a week, checking in with them. And that could be 15 minutes, and all this is being recorded, and notes are taking. And we're documenting everything. And then there's 3 or 4 more weeks of non-drug psychotherapy, and then a second MDMA session, and then that happens again, a third MDMA session, and that's it. And then 2 months later is when we evaluate them, and that's what's called the primary outcome measure. That's what is really used to show safety and efficacy. But then we
For
also
a non-psychiatrist, can you talk a little bit about the primary outcome measure?
Yes.
Is it made up of?
Yes. And here is our advantage. The primary outcome measure for PTSD is called the clinician-administered PTSD scale.
Okay.
And this was developed by the VA, and it's been updated constantly over the years. And it's been this is the CAPS 4 is what we've been using. The CAPS 5 is just coming out as they refine their understanding of this. And it has to do with certain kind of avoidance behaviors, certain kind of intrusion behaviors.
Avoidance behaviors, just like not going out?
Triggers, yeah. Something triggers your reminder of your trauma, and so you avoid this whole...
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, there's emotional hyperreactivity.
Gotcha.
Aspects of it. There are nightmares and... Then there's also emotional numbing. There's different kind of symptoms. And for us, the key issue is we use all these lower doses to try to find a place where there was a confusion between the doses, and then we would show a dose-response relationship that the more MDMA you got, the more therapy you got, the better you got. That it was, and then that's how we would deal with the double-blind issue, and that's how we would do the big phase 3 studies, would be these low doses compared to these, you know,
right.
the highest dose, the 125 milligrams. So, but it turned out the data was really different, is that the lower doses were made people uncomfortable, that they were opened a little, but their fear was not reduced enough. They were just, and that reduced the effect. They still got a little bit better. But the people that had the therapy without the MDMA with the placebo did even better. It kind of muted the therapy.
Wow.
It made them a little uncomfortable. But then what totally surprised us was at 75 milligrams compared to 125, the people got even better.
Right.
The medium dose, the 75 milligrams, often again 37 and a half after 1.5 to 2.5 hours, so it's a good dose. Those people did the best of all.
But 125, you're saying, is...
is great, okay, for a lot. But the 75 people did, milligram,
that's
people
it,
did even better.
Okay, okay, cool.
And that, but not for everybody, but that led us to a whole understanding and of what's really going on. And the relationship between the mystical experience and therapeutic outcome with MDMA and how that's different with psilocybin. That this, there's, you, people are more grounded when they take these medium doses. And
right,
what's happening is that their memories are coming back of their trauma, but their fear response is muted, and they're feeling this deep, deep self-acceptance, and they're looking back at the trauma from a perspective now.
Right.
And they're storing it into longer-term memory with an enhanced frontal cortex, thinking about it, and they're able to have this lay down, this kind of emotional tone that's different. So the next time they recall this memory,
gotcha,
the emotional tone. So that
so
memory
so,
reconsolidation.
So again, non-psychiatrist,
yeah,
sorry to cut you off.
Okay.
Very quickly, a trauma happens.
Yeah.
And so whatever it may be, whatever it is, some awful thing happens to you, you see your friend get blown up. And
right,
so this gets stored in your brain while you're experiencing massive releases of adrenaline, and is, are you saying that this memory is getting stored in a different part of the brain?
Yeah, there's, it's kind of a shorter term memory, and it's the and it's constantly re-triggered
so
by the emotional
stuck
tone. Yeah,
like it's so in so the, so in between the part of the brain that stores it for long term and the short term, it's getting stuck in short term and just sort of bouncing around. And
and the first like filter is like this fear reaction filter of, you know, is that something that we need to protect ourselves from, you know, so that this kind of instantaneous fear reaction to a trauma is, it keeps it in this, you know, but then it doesn't
it's
get
getting,
relaxed,
it's like
and it's not processed.
Digested.
It's not processed, yeah. Yeah, and that's why you can actually change these things within an instant, within
wow,
a different attitude, you know, and when your attitude is stuck, sometimes you give a drug and your chemistry changes.
Right.
And in a supportive context, you can look at things and it gets stored in a different way. That's called memory reconsolidation. And
wow,
now there's research being done at Rockefeller University. We just sent them, or sending them, 4 grams of MDMA for animals. They're looking at mechanisms of action. How does this actually work?
Yeah.
And how does certain fears get extinguished? And how does memory shift after, in response to a trauma, and when these animals are giving MDMA? So that's, the science is really developing, but the FDA doesn't care about that. The FDA doesn't care how it works. They just show, can you show it's safe, and can you show it helps somebody?
Huh.
And then the theory of how it works, people are suffering right now. So that's what I'm saying, the difference between knowledge,
yes,
and the science of drug development science. So that's what we're doing.
Right.
And this movement towards this negotiation with FDA, we have this tremendous advantage of the fact that the FDA is really interested in science over politics, this branch of the FDA.
Huh.
And this branch of the FDA reviews psychedelic research, reviews marijuana research, and they've been...
When did this branch of the FDA come into existence?
Well, I did my PhD at the Kennedy School of Government, and part of my dissertation was on this. This was the pilot drug evaluation staff. It began in 1989 and 1990, right around that year is when it started. And then they were looking at, a lot of the AIDS people had criticized the FDA for being too slow to approve drugs, too cautious.
Right.
And so they tried to say, how do we speed drug development up? So this was the pilot drug evaluation staff,
okay,
to pilot new drug evaluation ways, and they needed real drugs to work with. And so they had to, they looked around, all the other body parts were all captured by different divisions at the FDA, all the other drugs were all taken, so they had to take some drugs, and they took psychedelics and marijuana as,
wow,
weren't being used, which had been blocked for decades. And then they're like, okay, you know, we can handle the risks of these drugs. That's the argument that they made, that these are not that different from amphetamines. They're not that different from opiates. They're not different from tranquilizers, that the FDA knows how to regulate drugs.
Right.
I mean, this is like, there's politics about, you know, drug war and stuff, but
yes.
The FDA is like, these are just drugs, and we can control and manage it, so we want to let research happen. And that started in...
Well, that flies in the face of the kind of, like, stereotypical, like, paranoid hippie idea of the FDA as this drooling, evil bunch of ogres who want to ruin everything. That doesn't jive with what I've heard about the FDA.
Right, right. And that's the fundamental mistake a lot of people make, is they think in black and white terms, and they deem... they make overgeneralizations, and they go by patterns from the past that they don't update for the future.
Right.
That you have to look at what are the institutional mission of the different federal agencies, and then also what's the control system politically.
Right.
And the FDA has been very supportive, even against other government agencies telling them to shut stuff down. Here's what the FDA, that NIDA, which has the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has the monopoly on the supply of marijuana used in the United States, and has since 1968. We're trying to break that monopoly. But anyway, they...
What you mean, the supply of marijuana used for studies?
For studies, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so they've had this monopoly, and it's been a major obstruction to medical marijuana research. We're trying to end it, and they're just trying to block it. But with psychedelics, we have our own independent sources of supply. And so the normal way that FDA reviews a protocol is they review your design, and then where the drug comes from, they say, okay, if you've shown us that you've got the drug, great. If not, we put a clinical hold on it. But our normal way of reviewing things is to look at the science first, and then you work on the drug.
Yeah, sure.
So we did that multiple times. FDA said yes, but NIDA, with their monopoly, wouldn't sell us the marijuana. So
why?
NIDA then...
Why?
Because they want the propaganda of, you know, marijuana's bad, and studies
so
into
NIDA
the beneficial
really
uses.
Is.
But they've changed their mind. Now NIDA, things are changing all around them. So yes, they were. Now they want to get rid of this monopoly. And they want...
NIDA
doesn't want to have the monopoly. But
why?
Because they're getting so much pressure for it, and it costs them so much money. They have so much other stuff to do. And they're also, they've given up. Like, we need research. Everybody agrees we need research on medical use and foreign imports. So now some foreign producers of medical marijuana are going to try to get FDA standards. Right, so NIDA went to FDA. This is before their change of heart. They said, the FDA, stop approving protocols for MAPS for marijuana until we say yes or no that we'll sell it to them. We don't want Rick to say, hey, FDA said yes, and we won't sell them the marijuana.
Wow.
That's bad. So they filed form. They asked the FDA, stop doing that. Change your procedures. And I filed a protest with the FDA ombudsman about this, and it went through the channels, and it ended up, the FDA said to NIDA, forget it. We approved protocols.
That's cool.
Meeting in 1992. They were started in 89-90, around that. Then they approved Rick Strassman's study with DMT in 1990. And then Charlie Grobe and I were trying to get them to approve an MDMA study for cancer patients with anxiety. And so they convened this meeting in 92 and said, analyzed it and said, yes, we're going to open up the door to psychedelic research. We're going to treat it the same way as other research. And therefore,
and that's because of you.
That's because
of
me and Charlie and
no
Rick Strassman and and others, and Dave Nichols, all sorts of people were there. I mean, it was like a community effort. But there's like a point of pressure, and the point of pressure in this case was Charlie Grobe and my protocol for MDMA for cancer patients. We were saying we want to do something, and the same way that we're saying to the government and have since 2001, we want to grow marijuana for our own research. We want to break this monopoly. So the FDA is got really good people in it, and so for hippies to think the FDA is trying to control my vitamins and wipe out everything,
that's it.
There's nothing is monolithic. There's like fiefdoms even inside the FDA, because they each control different body parts and they can look at different drugs for different things. But look what the FDA just did. What is one of the most hot topics in America right now is these anti-abortion bills, the right-wing
Yes.
Trying to eliminate abortion all over America.
Yes.
What did FDA just do? They made the abortion pill, RU-46, easier to access, more in line with the science, even in the face of, you know, a lot of conservative political opinion not wanting them to do that. And the FDA did it. And that's where the FDA has got politicized about women's reproductive rights. But it just seems to delay things. They come, and with psychedelics, we don't really have the opposition. We're working, people are recognizing that the pharmaceutical medications that are available for PTSD, for certain anxiety, depression things, that they're palliative or they don't work that much. They don't like make it so.
What are the most popular currently the most popular medications used for PTSD?
There's two that are approved, SSRIs, Zoloft and Paxil. But if you talk to vets about what they're given by the VA, they have like a cocktail of like a massive number of different drugs that are, there's only two drugs approved for PTSD, but they try all these other drugs, Zoloft and Paxil. So what we're trying to do to demonstrate to the FDA, and that's what we talked about earlier today, and the breakthrough that happened in my mind today about how we're going to be able to do this is that you need to have two large-scale phase 3 studies. So we're trying to say that we've done about 105 people so far, and we think we're going to have to do about 450 more.
Right.
But the 450 more are divided into two studies, like, you know, 225 and 225, something like that. And the first one, we're going to get half the people are going to get the therapy that I described. It's around 40 hours of therapy with a male-female team. It takes place over 3.5 months. And once a month for 3 months, people get this 8-hour session, listening to music, half the time talking with the therapist. And half of those people will get just an inactive placebo, and the other half will get, on the first dose, 75 milligrams of MDMA with this optional supplemental dose. Then they can decide, in conjunction with the therapists, do they want to stay at that dose level or go to the higher, in which case it would be 125 milligrams.
Right.
And then again with the supplement. And then they would have the third dose, the third session, and they could, again, refine the dose a little bit.
Right.
So it's just these three sessions. And then at the and all, again, videotaped, and data is massive.
How
data gathering.
How do you pick these people?
How do we pick these people?
Yeah, are they people who have PTSD? Are they people who have tried MDMA before?
No, these are people that have had PTSD and have failed on currently available medications to get better. So they're called chronic treatment-resistant PTSD patients.
Does it matter if they've had experience with MDMA or a psychedelic?
Well, we do say that people can have had 5 prior experiences with MDMA.
Right.
But it may matter somewhat that they know what it is. You know, if you take it in a recreational setting sometimes and you haven't really felt comfortable to really be openly therapeutic in yourself and be more personal, I mean, that it's that there's something about the first bunch of sessions that affect people very deeply. Sometimes for different people, different times, there's kind of a slow muting of the effect over over a long time. But so we want to this is called subject enrichment. So what we're trying to do is see which population can we show that it's really going to work, and getting all the factors lined up. So our main thing is we're going to optimize therapeutic outcomes, and we're not being that efficient. That's why we have a male female. We have a 2-person therapy team.
Yes,
it's really better. Is it twice as better? Is it worth it? But we're doing it in a way where the second person can be a student learning. So it's a way to also train the next generation and have
a
lower cost.
Can the therapist take MDMA with the patient?
No. The therapists are the...
But the patients probably want that a little bit.
No, the patients want to have about half the time when people have taken MDMA, their eyes are closed, they're inner listening to music, they're telling themselves different stories. Generally, it's the therapist. They might bring in one or two of their favorite things, but that's kind of pre-patterned in a way. We want to not have them. We want to have them fresh. They've had, and supported.
So
sometimes they can say, "I don't want to hear, you know, that music."
Donovan, I don't want to hear Donovan.
Well, first off, we try to avoid mostly words. We mostly avoid music with words. Again, because the essence of the method is that once you the person's unconscious is activated by MDMA,
right?
And that's the guide. We're not the guide. We don't know best. We don't know, you know, the person that knows the person the best is themselves. And there's this inner wisdom of the order or whatever. And so what we...
What do you mean of the order?
Well, of there's a flow of experiences. So what I mean is that in an eight-hour session, some people will talk about the trauma early on.
Right.
Some people won't get till 6 hours later. Some people will go to a happy mood first. Or some people will just not even talk about the trauma. They'll talk about some other thing that you were just like... Again, stunned to hear that has some emotional resonance, but it's not this. It's like some different thing that happened at school that when they were five or, you know, but it's just like something that made a deep impression on them. You get into and then sometimes they are able to just go inside and tell themselves, just flow with these metaphors. They it's beautiful. They're talking in metaphors and poetry.
Can you give an example?
Somebody had a gorilla locked in his a wild animal locked in a cage inside him. They had to keep inside him all the time because if this wild animal would get out, and this was his military aggression.
Yeah.
And then he saw, and that if that it would, everything would. You know, but he saw as long as he was keeping this in the cage that it was going to be enraged. He had to somehow find a way to channel this energy and not just keep and letting out this, you know, and becoming friends with this wild animal.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So you've been in a session where someone is saying, I feel like there's a wild animal.
No, no, this was not a session that I was in. This was a session that
you've
was...
You've seen the recordings.
Yes, because this has been a... yeah.
So how does the therapist respond to that if the patient says, I have a wild animal inside of me? What's the response?
What does it feel like?
Yeah.
And so it's sort of this, you know, it's your wild animal. How do you relate to it? What does it mean to you? And you got to figure it out. But we're here to say that it's something that we believe... there's this self-healing mechanism inside you that this MDMA has helped catalyze, and that these burdensome symptoms that you've had, that it'll be helped if you take a dialogue with this wild animal. So
a self-healing mechanism.
Yeah.
What is that? What is the self-healing mechanism?
Well, what happens when you scratch your arm?
Yeah.
It heals.
It heals.
Where that's it. And the mind probably has something like that.
Okay, right. So somehow MDMA is accelerating that process or I guess you'd say
Or even dreaming. I'm saying that like that your psyche, the dreaming is part of you know, healing, reorganizing the brain. It's a healthy process.
Defragging the hard drive.
That there's this inner well of deeper feelings and of unconscious of things that are that emerge amazing under psychedelics.
Do you ever feel so you're sitting down with the FDA and I'll tell you what I briefly. What I might think of a psychedelic. I think a good psychedelic experience connects me with God is what I think. And there is an instantaneous healing that happens when you make a connection or you remember that you are connected, whatever way you want to say it.
Can you describe God a little bit?
Yeah, sure. He's got a six-pack. He hates gay people.
He's a he for sure.
And he's pissed, man. He's pissed. That's a great question. So,
So, with psilocybin, with LSD, with the classic psychedelics, that God experience, that mystical connection, that is part of the healing mechanism.
Right.
And that's what people who are scared of dying, who have life-threatening illnesses or have addictions, that helps them very, very much. But in the PTSD work, that's the distinction, is that it's about catharsis.
Okay. Okay.
Which is why we had the Burning Man on the Mall, in the Washington, D.C. Mall that we had. It was called Catharsis.
Okay.
And we had the first burn in many, many, many decades, maybe even 100 years. Yeah, this was...
The thing that just happened.
Yeah, it was sort of my instigation.
No way.
Yeah, and it was...
Can you describe that? Because some people who haven't heard of it, can you tell everyone what it was?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll backtrack and tell a little bit of how it came about.
Okay.
And just that... I've already talked about the government monopoly on marijuana. So we're suing the
NIDA.
NIDA owns this monopoly, but DEA is the one that holds the chokehold on the licenses. So NIDA is not really the resistance, the point of resistance. NIDA now says there should be an end of the monopoly, but it's the DEA that has this monopoly. They won't give other people licenses. So we're suing the DEA. Professor Craker, we have big DC law firms helping us and the American Civil Liberties Union, and it's about... a lot of testimony, and I was one of the witnesses, and we were actually doing really well and looking like we were persuading this administrative law judge, which we eventually did, but I was one of the witnesses, and at that I testified because it was going to be marijuana grown for maps and what we're going to do
sure.
with it and why do we need to do it, and the prosecution, the sort of the DEA lawyers, at the end of the day, they tried to discredit my testimony. I'd made a really strong impression with the judge with what we presented, and then they tried to discredit me personally because that's what they try to do if they can't
that's
deal
right.
with your arguments. And so we had prepared for that, and the only way they could try to do that was to talk about, did I smoke marijuana? Was I a criminal?
Oh, man.
And so we had all figured it out that they're probably going to ask that, and the lawyers were going to object because I'm not asking for the license. It's this Professor Craker who's worked at military labs growing stuff to go after coca plants, and you know, is the
right.
top scientist. That I wasn't even going to be there. It was irrelevant. So we were prepared for that. The lawyers said, "Okay, it's irrelevant." And then the judge surprised us, and she said, "This was in a criminal case. You can plead the Fifth, and the judge cannot draw any negative inferences. It's your constitutional right, and you just choose to use it." And
yeah,
but in a civil case, which is this is the judge. If you don't answer a question, the judge can assume whatever she wants to assume. And the DA was like, "I'm an addict, and I'm going to steal this government, you know, this marijuana that I'm
right.
spending all these years trying to get legal
That's
marijuana."
That's your plan. You're just a clever hippie who's figured out a way
and
to get a lot of weed.
Right, I'm addicted to marijuana, and I'm gonna, you know, you know, as if. Yeah, so I decided
amazing.
that I would answer the question, and I said, "Yeah, I smoke a couple times a week," and then it was a delicate moment because it wasn't clear what they would do with the information, but it wasn't enough for a search warrant, and it would have. The judge, they started asking me, "Well, where do you get your marijuana?" And I'm like, "This is ridiculous." And then the judge just stopped their line of questioning. So they used it against me. And I felt like my own use of marijuana, my own psychedelic use, had sort of hurt the cause, kind of.
Right.
And I felt like I felt bad. And there was this break in the testimony. And then it was going to come back again. It was 4 days. It was going to come back again in a couple months. And between that break was Burning Man.
All right.
So I go to Burning Man, and I'm just like, my spirit is like, I want to fight back. I want it to be accepted. I want, you know, it shouldn't be used again. This.
Right.
And then I saw that there was this, I want to bring my Burning Man self, my psychedelic self, also to Washington, D.C.,
yes.
and not be, and be proud of it.
Sure.
And so I thought, hey, there's this kind of... sacred space at Burning Man between the man and the temple. And for a bunch of years, the temple was like these kind of spread out horizontal structures, and the man is always this vertical structure. So
yeah.
The man is like the Washington Monument.
Okay.
Mapping the sacred space of Burning Man on the sacred space of America, which is the mall and the
yeah.
Capitol. And
yes,
so
yes.
The Capitol is like the temple, and that's what
yeah.
people get. And then,
sure.
Okay, so then I thought, okay, God, if we could do this. That would be like the full expression,
Whoa.
Freedom. And Adam Eidinger, who works with and for David Bronner, who helped legalize marijuana in the District of Columbia, is an activist. And I was in Washington one time. This was now about eight years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And it was an SSDP conference. And after the conference was a protest on the Washington Mall. And it went, it had a band, it had music. They're protesting the Iraq War. It was the Thievery Corporation.
Wow.
And it was fantastic. It went till 2 in the morning. And then I thought, wow, well, if we could do this till sunrise, if we could really have like this all night cathartic protest of the drug war, you know, if we could do this, it would be a freedom. It would be utterly, you know, we would be, this would be our country, we'd be free, sort of. And so that's how, but it took 10 years to try to figure out like how to really do it. And so you can't just have a party on the mall. It has to be a protest.
Right.
You have to protest something, and it has to be a political expression. And what we really wanted to express is the drug war, and that's what was all of this was wrapped up into. And so when it finally was possible, because Adam had experience working with the National Park Service already.
Yes.
And that he'd been he had a lot of support for his marijuana legalization efforts and his political activism in D.C. He had really good connections. And the burner community had evolved to the point where they had a lot of different skills and were all throughout the the system. And so I finally felt like, how do you do the all-night dance, though? How do you do that? And I was like, well...
So just, you're thinking, how do I bring Burning Man to D.C.?
Yes.
This is your idea. I'm going to bring Burning Man to D.C. to protest the war on drugs.
Well, it was just to yes, that we that we're Americans. That this the Burning
this
Man is
okay. It,
this is America. This is innovation. This is healthy. This is society building. This is not tune in, turn on, drop out, or this is not revolution and we're tear down the system.
Right.
You know, this is not the '60s. This is different. It's about how this can be integrated and energized, and that's so our Burning Man cells should be like right there. You know, there's Christian fundamentalists, you know, setting up tents on the Washington Mall,
but
telling their stories. They should be able to do that.
Your job is you have
this is symbolic. My job is like symbolic social change. So in a way, I'm trying to do not individual psychotherapy, but social psychotherapy for sick policies and to help people get ready for psychedelic experiences.
But some part of you must feel. On a professional level, you have so much riding on these studies that you're currently doing with MDMA. And to risk blowing the whole thing with an action like what just happened, it's really curious. Like, how do you justify that level of risk? Because what happens if some of these feds see you out there and they're like, see, this is just a classic hippie who loves smoking weed. Aren't you worried that this will invalidate all of your research?
That's a fantastic question. And you've sort of put your finger on one of the main divides in the psychedelic research community. It's a tremendously important issue, but different people see it differently. And the way that I see it is that it protects. There's a risk in doing it, but the kind of direct confrontation to the war on drugs, the kind of we need psychedelic harm reduction, we need all these things, you know, should be legal. That direct kind of progress on larger drug policy protects the work that we're doing with psychedelics and makes a backlash less likely rather than more likely. And the risk that we had was we got a permit for it. I mean, this is what we're saying. We're trying to do this in the open with understanding and that we're going to be responsible.
Yeah.
And so we were able to say that this was a tremendous experiment by the National Park Service in democracy and that this would not be a pot-smoking event. This was not like this was a Burning Man, burning the temple, kind of sacred, and in this community, and also all-night cathartic dancing, and then the night before, you know, symposia and drug war stories, people telling the stories of what, and that was a total addition. I hadn't envisioned that. That was just fantastic, you know.
Cool.
thing. And so we were able to have...
nobody got busted, right?
No, it worked out great. It worked out great. And for me, the highlight of the whole thing was we had the Zendo there. We had a whole space set up. The Zendo project...
The Zendo is your psychedelic harm reduction. It's part of the... So you guys go to music festivals with these Zendos, formerly known as freak-out tents, right? That's what it is. But if someone's having a difficult trip, they go to these places, and you have people trained to help them.
Yes. And it's a little bit of a direct response, again, to the freak-out, in a way. That it's not about talking people down. One of the principles is talk through, not talk down.
Right.
So that we give people an opportunity to sort of feel comfortable enough to wrestle with this, you know, inner monster or whatever they envision that it is, so that they can kind of see that. And part of that is that's a risk, okay? We're dealing with people who are doing illegal drugs, and we're trying to do stuff with the DEA. On the other hand, we're reducing the fear of parents of their kids flipping out at these events, and we're also doing a service, taking these people shouldn't be arrested, and we're trying to help with the whole general.
Can we do something real quickly, because I think this is, of all the education that MAPS does, to me the most important is teaching people how to deal with their friend when they start having a freak out.
Right.
And I was wondering, can we very quickly, I'm going to act like I'm freaking out.
I want you
to give me first the wrong way to deal with it and then the right way to deal with it. Okay. So very quickly, we'll pretend I've taken a lot of mushrooms. You and I are hanging out and you're the bad friend.
All right.
Give the example of the bad way to deal with it. All right.
Okay.
So let's do it really quickly. Oh, Rick. I keep hearing cops everywhere, man. I keep hearing cops everywhere, and I feel like I'm pretty sure I'm having a heart attack.
Don't pay attention to that. It's not important. Just try to distract yourself, and you know, the more you think about bad stuff, the worse it's going to get. So don't even think about that.
I am having a heart attack.
You're doing this to yourself now.
I want my mom. I came from her womb.
What have you taken? Do you know what you've taken? Do you know what?
I took some mushrooms.
Do you know around how long ago you've taken them, or do you have any idea of time? Or are your friends? Where's your friends? Where's the rest of the friends?
I can't find my friends.
Okay, we've got a space for you. You're gonna be fine. We'll, you know, now you just take care of yourself. Have you been drinking? Do you have any water? Do you need any fruit juice?
I would like some fruit juice.
Okay, here's some fruit juice. We've got a special porta potty right over here if you need to. But we have this place to lie down, and we have these people trained to talk to you. So if you'd like to come
in.
That's
cool.
Okay, so then you start talking about you want your mother. Well, your mother died when you were 3 years old. Or you start telling this a story, and it comes from you, and then like,
just listen.
We're listening. We'd be supportive, and
it's beautiful. and so many people, you know, when their friends are flipping out, they don't know how to deal with it, and it's a really confusing space to be in, because quite often you're high when your friend's flipping out.
Yeah,
the
most important thing to know is that it's not like once it starts to go bad, then you're sunk. You know, that the way out is to go fully into it. And so the first thing is you create a safe space. You make it so people can have an interior experience. They don't have to pay attention to the outside world.
Okay.
And that safe space can take place in the middle of chaos, even. If you just have a friend or somebody creates a space around you where you can just lie down, or you could do it in a crowd, but it's better if you can, you know, find some safe space. And then you try to get a sense of just the likely trajectory. And part of creating a safe space is, okay, maybe I'm going to be here for the next 8 hours. Or, you know, you provide this consistent. So we have people that have the shifts and the time to make a long-term commitment to this process.
Right.
And then that helps people relax too. But we also, you know, sometimes have shift changes, and but people have this stable environment. And then they're encouraged to, you know, talk through, not talk down. But we're encouraged to think of ourselves as sitters, not guides.
Right.
So it's like we're not guiding.
The guide thing's kind of old hat, right? People kind of look at that now as like that's not the way to do it.
Well, it's an okay word, and people use it, and I think it's taken to mean like creating a context for people.
But quite often it means being like around a patronizing friend. Yeah, who's like, yeah. You see the flower of life. Go into it. Surrender to the flower of life.
Okay, now what you're talking about is guided imagery. All right, so there's a whole different way of therapy with guided imagery. Yeah. So one time, our method is not it's imagery that you generate. We don't even use words in the music if we can. But there was one time where I was sitting with someone who was actually PTSD from 9/11.
Okay.
And there was a woman psychiatrist and myself working with this fella in this TP at Burning Man, trying to help him work through this 8 years before, and was
how
really.
How did you make contact with him?
Actually, I've been wanting. I'm telling you, I do symbolic. I had wanted something like that for years and hadn't quite gelled. And then he was actually camping with David Bronner at Burning Man 1 year, and so I met him through David Bronner. And
when you say you'd been wanting to work with someone who had
PTSD from 9/11. Okay, I thought we're oppressed. We're trying to tell a story. We're trying to tell stories to frighten public about drugs and psychedelics. And
right.
Yeah. So I sort of had this idea of that would be a good, if that would develop. And then people are symbols and they're people there and they're individuals at the same time. And you
right.
kind of like keep that straight. And
yeah, sure.
Yeah. So while we were doing this work, there was another people who were comfortable with psychedelics but weren't like trained therapists.
Right.
And they were working with a woman who had been raped at Burning Man before.
Wow.
Years before, and had kind of overcome it by trying to help help promote dialogue about sex at Burning Man.
Right.
The Bureau of Erotic Discourse.
Cool.
but there were still issues about the rape and the trauma from that, right? So these other people were working with her, and they were doing guided imagery, just like you were saying. And I was just in the back of my head thinking, okay, we've got this method. We wouldn't do that. It worked.
It worked.
It's okay because a lot of it is people are doing their own internal work.
Right.
You know, and what you're saying helps some or helps a lot, but starting to help integrate this into this MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, we're working with various therapists trained, affiliated with the VA, researchers there who've developed new methods for treating PTSD,
yes.
but have developed non-drug psychotherapies. And there's several of them now. The key one is called prolonged exposure, where you just repeat the trauma over and over, and eventually you get deadened to it, and then you are cured.
Huh.
I mean, that's one of the main methods. There's thousands of therapists
wow.
trained in prolonged exposure.
Wow.
And it can help to some degree some people, but there's a lot of people it's re-traumatizing too.
Sure, it sounds brutal.
It's hard. And so they want to see blending MDMA with that. There's another one, the first one that we're going to start in about a month or so, which is a fantastic study. There's couples therapy, and it's where one member of the couple has PTSD, and it affects the relationship. And so it's a form of couples therapy to support the person with PTSD, but to acknowledge the way it's affecting
wow.
the relationship. And so the VA, National Center for PTSD, when we first started thinking about what to blend, how they might use MDMA, they just thought MDMA, love drug, hug drug, you know, just made them think about this couples therapy study. And so we have now got permission to give both members of the couple MDMA.
How cool.
And couples therapy is something that the way it's structured, it's not a disease. So we can't make MDMA into a medicine through the FDA for couples therapy because
right.
it's not a disease. But it's a really important use of MDMA.
It's
fantastic.
Like the primary use.
It's one of the best uses. Yeah. That's why it became one of the most popular drugs in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, couples therapy, relationships. And,
sure.
and so we're sort of backing into it by using, we're studying PTSD. but we're helping to blend. So we have our method. Other things can work. We're trying. The core element is what's called the therapeutic alliance. And that's that first part that friends can do for other friends, create a safe space. It's the alliance between the therapist and the patient about how they're working together. There's a trusting, safe, supportive right. environment. And that in the psychotherapy outcome research has shown to be the most important factor, more than the school of psychotherapy that
but
you have.
Everything that you're talking about is obviously beautiful, but so many of us, we do not have a therapeutic alliance. We don't even have therapists. We have our friends that we right. like to trip with.
Right.
Can we create this therapeutic yeah. alliance
yeah.
with friends?
Yes, totally. I see that's why it's a sense of safety and trust. And so when I think the key mistake is that a bunch of friends say, we're going to take drugs, we're going to go and have a party, we're going to go to this event, it's going to be fun. And that's all we're looking for. And then if somebody has something deeper coming up, then that's a sign that it's going wrong. Suppress it. Here, take this tranquilizer. You know,
yes.
we're out here to have fun. Then you end up worse off. So I think that that's the thing to avoid is when you take these drugs, you sort of should sign on for whatever this emergence is.
Right.
And not just try to narrow, okay, only the happy, you know, whatever. And because
right.
the other time it deepens the happiness. We even have a measure we use called the post-traumatic growth inventory. It's about how people can grow after trauma. In response, it makes them refine what they want to spend their time on or realize how precious it is to be just kind to somebody. Or
yeah.
You know, that there's all of these ways in which people can grow and integrate trauma. And so we're just trying to look both at the therapy component, the MDMA component, and we're trying to go for a cure, a durable remission. Sometimes it will come back. We're trying to help people be without drugs, to work through these issues. And we do find that some people, you know, life continues to traumatize people
yeah,
sometimes. And if you've been traumatized like that, you're more vulnerable. So there's some relapse rate, and we actually have gotten permission from FDA to give another MDMA session to people. And we're trying to integrate this into America. That's what we're talking about. And so before, though, yeah, okay, about MDMA, though, is this search for, you know, a cure to help people be without it, and they may relapse.
Yes.
But so the whole work we're doing with marijuana, now we have a $2.1 million grant from the state of Colorado to study marijuana for PTSD in 76 veterans.
Cool.
And this is something we've been trying for 6 years. It's taken forever to get this study approved. And now, because we're doing nonprofit drug development, we give away our protocol, and there's a for-profit company in Canada that's Tilray, and they want to do some research. So they're going to replicate our protocol but using their marijuana, and then they're going to have it vaporized. We're going to have it smoked. And then there's a whole study now in the University of Sydney, Australia, with the same protocol. This grandfather had a granddaughter who had pediatric epilepsy, and nothing helped her, and then CBD helped her, and he gave like $34 million to the University of Sydney, the largest
wow.
grant in their entire history for cannabis research. So now they're going to use the protocol, and it'll be edibles. So we'll have
cool.
the same kind of thing. But the thing about marijuana is that it's more of a palliative treatment that people tend to use it every day. It
right.
doesn't reorder the brain and memory in quite the same way that MDMA does that we've described. That the marijuana...
What about LSD? Does it reorder the brain in a similar way?
LSD is more like the MDMA or psilocybin. Yeah, you can repattern, but there's a... yes, you can. Yeah, definitely.
A similar effect.
A similar effect, but there's a more of a challenge to the ego, more of a challenge to letting go,
right.
more a little bit scarier, and also a little bit less biographical, more, you know, what does it mean to just be human and live and die and more general kind of things.
Right.
And we're with MDMA for memory reconsolidation. It helps to be stuck in your biography. This takes you kind of out of the other
right.
second. And then you have these more mystical experiences that then can also be therapeutic in a different way of
right.
making you feel connected and less lonely or more loving or more self-accepting and more beyond your narrow ways of thinking, and more, you know, these people that are black people, you know, they're not really different than me, or you
right.
know, these Islamic people, you know, well, you know, the Sufis are Islamic. You know, there's these mystical branches of all these
sure.
religions that are happy to, like, with each other and pray with each
right.
other, and it's not like, you know, but the fundamentalists are really too rigidly holding on and
well,
violent.
Do you,
and
do you this is my final question for you because you're clearly a pioneer and you're someone who is in a relatively small but very active group of people
yeah.
who are working on getting this stuff into the mainstream.
Yeah.
If it works.
Uh-huh.
Everything that you're trying to accomplish is accomplished.
Right.
What kind of world, what kind of America are we living in 10 years or so if everything works out?
Okay. Well, I can tell you, like, over the next 30 years.
Okay.
All right. So, because things will roll out, I don't think it's like instantaneous change. So I think that in 5 years from now, we believe that we will be able to present evidence to the FDA about the safety and efficacy of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD, and that we will have treated maybe, 450 people in our studies, but then treated maybe another 1,000 people on a compassionate basis, or another 500 people on a compassionate basis, and that then once MDMA is approved, we're going to set up psychedelic clinics, and other people will set up psychedelic clinics. We will train therapists. Only people that have trained in the method by the sponsor can prescribe. They don't have to stick with the method. They can say their wisdom is to do it this way or that way, but they have to get the basic safety from the...
So not all doctors will be able to prescribe.
No, this would be like... the best way to think about it is hospice centers, kidney dialysis
sure.
centers, methadone clinics.
Got
sort
you.
Of. This is a psychedelic clinic.
Okay.
Now, we're moving forward with MDMA. Usona Hefter is moving forward with psilocybin for end of life. So these will be multi-purpose. There's ketamine being used all over
for
depression. So these are going to be psychedelic clinics. But ketamine, where it's used, it's generally not used with psychotherapy. It's used just as a pharmacological shock that ketamine helps in people that are refractory to depression. I think it would be more effective if they also encased it in this therapeutic, a little bit of a therapeutic context with ketamine.
And the therapy that you've developed for MDMA would be the same kind of therapy.
Yeah,
for all
ketamine just lasts an hour. It's a whole different thing. You can't really talk to people as much with
right.
ketamine. It's different. So with psilocybin, when it's being used in therapy, it's maybe 80 or 90% people having their own nonverbal experiences, listening to music, and only 10 or 20% of dialogue with the therapist about what's going on. It's more people left on their own to have these wordless kind of experiences.
Right.
But with MDMA, it's more half and half. So
we have these clinics that start springing up.
Yeah, so these clinics eventually, now here's a 30-year model, which is the first hospice center was in 1974. By 2004, there was over 3,500 of them.
Right.
So we're going to have all of these, we're going to have psychedelic clinics all over, and they will grow starting actually, you know, 5 years from now with approval, and even before with the researchers. And then what we're going to be seeing is medicalization leads to people's changing minds about criminalization of these drugs.
Right.
We've seen legalization of marijuana grow as medical marijuana has grown, because people can understand, they see people that use it, they trust what they're seeing, they get more comfortable. So the medicalization helps people understand risk-benefit and get more comfortable about legalization and public health approaches to abuse rather than criminal justice. And then with MDMA, what we're going to, and with these psychedelic clinics, the legalization of marijuana is going to come first. When? I don't know. My conservative, you know, guess, let's just say, is somewhere like 2024 on a federal level. It
right.
may even come before then. And what may come is the Congress passing something that just says states can decide.
Right.
Like the end of alcohol prohibition. But let's just say 2024. Rob Campy at the Marijuana Policy Project says it could be 2019.
Wow.
You know, so I don't want to get, we'll just see. So then you get these psychedelic clinics that grow starting in 2021 till 2030 and spread. And then we also have the progression of religious use.
Right.
So we have religious freedom for ayahuasca in these two different religions. The Native American church uses peyote. It's hard to create new religions where,
right,
you know, this is central. These drugs are central. I mean that's...
Leary tried the League of Spiritual Discovery.
Yeah, and the sometimes, you know, marijuana smugglers claim to be Rastas. And,
yes.
You know, it's hard to do that. So in our cultural and legal context, medicine is the open door.
That's it.
And you can help. Religious use is great because the religious use of even small groups of ayahuasca users has what I've seen is that there's a deepening interest in ayahuasca in people in America of all different kinds in a kind of reverential, you know, but without police interference.
Right.
So that the police car just like passes right by.
Yeah, right.
You know, so
yeah.
So that there's this whole in the law they call it the penumbra, the umbrella, the shadow of, you know, this law. But here
yeah.
we have these legal Supreme Court cases legitimizing peyote
right.
by the Native American Church and legitimizing ayahuasca by the Union de Vecchio.
Right.
And so people are using ayahuasca all over in a more or less unhindered way.
Yeah.
There's just been several people in Israel have been arrested by the Israeli police for ayahuasca.
Huh.
The world community of ayahuasca experts and lawyers is trying to help them make a case. But there can be crackdowns. Because who is a religion? I mean, sorry, but medicine, there's a pathway. It's
right.
science. We do it. So,
yes.
So I think that by 2035, we're going to have clinics everywhere. People will have gotten used to the legalization of marijuana. People will be, in general, getting more spiritualized. That's what globalization is forcing on all of us anyway.
Yes.
And the penalties are going to be going down for the criminal use of
right.
MDMA. There was just a terrific, Dr. John Elbrin did something fantastic just the other day. He testified in a case, somebody was busted related to MDMA and similar kind of drugs. And what we've been saying is that the sentencing commission that set up the mandatory guidelines
yes.
for how much time you get for certain amounts,
yeah.
that they did that in, I think it was 2001. I testified. They ignored all our testimony.
Five-year mandatory minimum for LSD.
They're just, you know, it was irrational. And it's the same thing they did with crack cocaine and powder cocaine and the disparities there. So the testimony in the court case was that the judges in these MDMA cases don't need to go by these mandatory minimum guidelines because they were made in a time of irrational hysteria and the
right.
science has passed by and they haven't updated. And so the judges don't have to go. And
that's great.
They won.
That just happened?
Yeah, that just happened just the other day.
Oh, that's
and that's
so
like
great.
The third or fourth case like that.
Wow.
So there's going to be more. It's incredible. So
it's
that's the use again of science. That's the other thing. OK, so now we're taking science. We provide with the ACLU. The ACLU is what pioneered this approach.
Yes.
With a lot of our evidence that we got from the MDMA studies. And that's getting us into the political arena. And I think that makes us safer rather than less safe.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So that's it. So you're saying by 2030...
By 2030, we're going to have clinics, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clinics. But I think by 2040, you know, 2035 or so, I think it'll be legal. Yeah, I think it'll be legal. All psychedelics, we will have a culture. And what we're going to have, and this maybe is a good way to, you know, conclude, is that we're going to have a culture that is more spiritualized and they will be more able to deal with these constant challenges without having to demonize others, scapegoat others, without indulging the fears and the worst sides of our nature that will be strengthened by the use of these substances in proper supportive ways to be more balanced human beings, and we'll be able to move towards transcending these limitations and prejudices and appreciate differences. It won't be the end of, it's not like a homogenous soup of one thing. It's like everybody's just fine with who they are and delighted to see who everybody else is, however different they are. And this will be the antidote to war. And this Einstein said that the, you know, we need a new mode of thinking. or else we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. What the new mode of thinking is, this spiritual kind of globalization, and it's the shift from fundamentalism to mysticism.
Cool.
And that's what we'll have. If we look at us, the other social change movements that have succeeded recently, gay rights, I mean, there's still a lot of struggles, but gay marriage, what has been instrumental to their success? It's been gay people coming out and owning who they are. And often people are completely surprised by who's gay. They've been hiding it, but they've gone to all corners of our society. They've accomplished everything, and they're just like the rest of us, and they need to be accepted. And so the coming out part is really important. So we've organized for our 30th anniversary the series of global psychedelic dinners. And they could go to the MAPS.org website and read about these dinners. And what we're asking people to do is to share with their friends, to invite people and have these dialogues about what psychedelics have meant to them or what they hope for or want to learn about psychedelic research. And at the same time that they're sort of helping this coming out process and telling their stories, then they can get more comfortable telling it to other people and sort of having it be more out in the open.
So anyone can do these dinners?
Yeah. And right now what we're trying to do as part of our making MDMA into a medicine is we're buying a kilogram of MDMA, medical grade MDMA, and it's costing us $400,000.
Wow.
For a kilogram. That's 8,000 doses. So it's roughly $50 a dose, 125 milligrams.
Wow.
But it's...
That's exceedingly more than the normal cost of a dose these days.
Yeah, because most of it is the documentation, the paperwork. So
right.
At least this initial batch, $74,000 is going towards validating the methods that are used to make this batch.
Okay.
Because we have to make a batch, but it also has to be in a way that could scale way up for when it becomes a medicine.
Right.
And the same company that makes pharmaceutical medicines for all different companies.
Right.
And so... it's for the paperwork. We have to, unfortunately, spend $53,000 to do a stability study, a three-year stability study, even though the MDMA that we currently use was made in 1985. It's 31 years old and it's working great. And we know that it'll make it for 3 years. So anyway, the price will go down. But we're asking people to go to these dinners, tell their stories, and if they are motivated to donate towards our purchase of this, participate with us in a legal drug deal to purchase MDMA
cool.
to make it into a medicine that we'll use all over the world. And we have our 30th anniversary celebration that's going to take place April 17th, free from any kind of police interference, with full support of the police, because we're helping trauma with police officers. We got a police officer in our PTSD study.
Wow.
We got veterans, firefighters, including another one from 9/11. And police officers. And so the April 17th, Sunday, from 5 to 11 Pacific time, we're having our 30th anniversary banquet, celebration, and entertainment. It's going to be an incredible event.
Cool.
And different people giving talks. And it's going to be live stream at maps.org/live30.
Great.
And Andre Jones and Phaedra, it's going to be Ken Jordan of Crystal Method.
Cool.
There's going to be just an incredible kind of movie by DJ Spooky, music and movie about the creation of the universe in this gorgeous facility created for Masonic rituals, the Scottish Rite
cool.
Temple.
Cool, nice.
And we're going to have a lot of interesting talks from patients,
therapists. But
you must
be sold out for tickets for that, right?
No, actually we're not. No, we're not. Yeah, we have like 500 more. I mean,
wow.
This is a big spot. Yeah, so this is for people that are in the Bay Area. This should be
that
incredible.
That sounds so fun. Oh, I wish I was going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. Sunday from 5 to 11. And it's live stream all over. And it's just every once in a while you kind of have to celebrate. And
yes.
Even though for us, I really – Shakespeare said something incredible, many things. But one of the things that really struck me is he said, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. You know, that you think you've got it. And it's like almost there. And then you spill it on yourself
right.
or something. So that – you know, we're just sort of gathering our energy and confidence to kind of, but not be overconfident as the hardest steps are ahead.
Right.
To really train hundreds of therapists and go in 20 different sites to do the research in Europe and the United States and elsewhere. And so
it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And
thank God you're the one at the helm. It's you're doing such wonderful things. Friends listening, please definitely. Go to the links. I'll have all the links in the comment section of this
Podcast. Oh, one last other thing. Yeah. Psychedelics because we are also believing that being involved in the struggles of the day makes us safer rather than less safe. So there's a hashtag psychedelics because it's a whole dialogue about, again, this coming out. Psychedelics are important to me because
right.
I value them. Or
that's cool.
And so we're trying to get this really large like discussion going as well.
Great. Beautiful. I'll have all the links at DuncanTrussell.com. Again, thank you very much, Rick.
Great.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thanks for listening.